Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo. And tonight we have two interviews for you that we did last night. Our first interview will be with Larry Dorman. This is pre-recorded, so. But our first interview is with Larry Dorman, who's the Public Affairs Coordinator for the AFSCME Union. And he will be talking with us about the economic stimulus package and trying to make sense out of it like we are and try to break it down for us. I don't know exactly if we got too far without kind of being frustrated by it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, after yesterday's great speech by our Treasury Secretary, what's his name, Eichner? Eichner is on, I forget. But...
I can't think of his name.
Worth or? No, that's not correct. Anyway, so regardless, I mean, we don't even know his name at this point. I forgot his name. But anyway,
go ahead.
Well, you know, after he spoke yesterday, stock market went down 386 points.
So much for him.
Yeah, you know, because they said, this guy doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. And I was listening to NPR this morning, and they were discussing it. And then the guy said, "He says this is not a plan. This is insane." He says, "You know, this is something he really
I didn't know
no
what
confidence
he,
whatsoever in this.
He thing. Didn't really have a plan.
He said nobody knows what the hell they're doing. He
no.
said that it made obvious sense to them after watching that." That he didn't know what the hell he was doing.
But that the Republicans don't have a plan, and they got us to where we are.
Yeah.
So I don't think they have much right to criticize.
No, I don't either, actually. Also.
You know, they're the ones that made the mess. What if they've offered substantively
yeah.
to help us get out of this mess? Nothing but criticism.
That's right.
For anybody that wants to do anything.
That's right. And, I mean... And even with that, I mean, I can understand.
And plus they gave away trillions of dollars to their buddies.
Yeah, Paulson's buddies. You don't hear anything from Paulson anymore, the architect of this miserable plan. Okay, you don't hear anything about Bush anymore. He's probably, got his little bunker all set up there for...
He's finishing the fake story that he read about a ghost.
I hope everybody goes to this guy's house in Dallas, Texas, and just pickets his house and throws stuff at him. Yeah, I think that's going to happen.
I think they ought to get some shoes.
Shoes, absolutely, yeah. They start throwing some shoes at this guy because it's really sick, disgusting.
Do we have a few minutes to read a few things?
I didn't know if you wanted to.
I
thought
we
could, but I don't know. Do you have anything you wanted to?
The only thing I wanted to talk about was that California prepares to start paying bills.
Yeah, I know.
That was kind of shocking.
That's bizarre, isn't it? I mean, a whole state stops paying its bills.
It's going to issue IOUs.
Yeah.
The state of California has run out of money. Facing a $42 billion budget deficit, state controller John Chang told the Sacramento Bee, I guess that's a newspaper,
yeah.
He has already borrowed $21.5 billion to try to cover the state's checks, but by February 1st, this was posted in January, there will be no more options left but to simply stop paying some of the bills, including tax refunds, welfare checks, student grants, and other payments owed to California citizens. Federal law requires that many school and health care programs, a total of $6.6 billion in California, must be paid. The Los Angeles Times reports, so Chang has announced an expected payment freeze and $3.7 billion worth of state bills, most of it refunds owed to taxpayers. But even with the freeze beginning next week, the Time reports California will still fall $346 million short for the month of February, forcing Chang to consider something only done once since the Great Depression, issuing IOUs. Formerly called registered warrants, the state's IOUs consist of a little more than a piece of paper that states that the state owes the payee money plus interest to be paid at some point in the future. The last time California issued registered warrants was in 1992, during the two-month budget battle between the then-Governor Pete Wilson and the state's legislators. But after the state issued almost $4 billion worth of IOUs, many banks stopped accepting them as deposits, claiming the 5% interest didn't pay for the hassle of processing them. The Times reports that state officials have already designed an IOU template for February and began negotiating with banks to avoid a repeat of the 1992 problem. But now state officials are hoping that Chang's promised payment freezes can delay the budget crisis long enough for General Schwarzenegger and the legislature to find a solution. So, we are the eighth largest economy, Chang said, speaking of California's rank among the world's nations. We're an independent country. But comparing it to other states, he said, we have the 50th, or we are tied for the last in the credit rating. We are a world economic power, but we have fiscal mismanagement in this state. Now, whose fault is that?
I just wanted to mention one more, and then we'll go to the interviews. This was from Guardian. .co.uk.
Before you start on that, I just wanted to ask you, did you hear, this was posted January 26th, did you hear that they actually did issue those IOUs?
That was a big thing. As far as I know, it's by what, when is it the deadline?
February 1st.
February 1st. I don't know if they did.
I didn't hear anything about it.
Because the bailout didn't touch them yet. They were hoping that the bailout would be passed before then. So I don't think it's going to happen, but, as far as I know, it already did, okay? The Senate passed it, and I think the House passed it.
Yeah, they just have to work on consolidating it and making it work, because there were differences in the two bills.
Well, the one that I heard was signed was like, $719 billion, something like that. They cut out to do $100 billion out of that.
Really? That's a lot of money.
It started off at 825. Senate version was 900. And then they cut it down to like 7-something. All right? And I really think they cut out too much. But
if you're going to pass it, you should pass it with teeth.
Yeah, pass it with teeth, right? Because it could be that extra $100 billion that makes the difference.
That's right.
And not,
rather than,
you know, just cutting it off.
Yeah,
it's a lot of money, but biggest problem we got now is we got to worry about the inflation. I think it's gonna cause a tremendous amount of inflation, which it will, because you're throwing another $1 trillion into the country, into the world, and devaluing.
They didn't seem to worry about it when they bailed out the bankers and the.
No, they didn't. But the problem is the Federal Reserve has lent $4 trillion to these banks already. That they didn't tell us about. It wasn't in the stimulus plan.
Mm.
Can you imagine that? So, taxpayers stiffed with $4 trillion in deficits. There was a lot of dirty shenanigans that happened, and unfortunately, you know, this.
Yeah, I remember that wasn't written into the bill.
Yeah, and it's just a nightmare. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But I mean, all we can do is hold on to our seats. And the second interview tonight, I hope you really enjoy it. It's with Jean Lemlin, and she's the author of the Vegetarian Classics 300 Quick and Easy Recipes. It's a good book, and we had a really nice talk with her last night.
Oh, she was
and,
a lovely woman.
Yeah, I talked about her book. We have her
we
book.
We could hardly wait to run home and start cooking.
Yeah. And think about this if you're thinking about listening to this, staying up for this one. 6 ounces of white chocolate for a white chocolate raspberry cheesecake. Yeah. You know, it's worth getting the full recipe because we read it. I think we read it.
Oh, it was very good.
But we talked about it, so I hope you'll enjoy it. And anyway, here's Larry Dorman and Lila and Leo, and enjoy.
Yeah, it was a good interview.
Yeah. This is going to go beyond the midnight hour here, but we'll have time to have both in the 60 minutes. If not, it'll be the rest of the interview with Gene will be on or Larry or whatever, possibly it'll probably be the Gene interview, you can get just by going to our archives. So I want to thank you, and have a pleasant evening while you listen to this, and we will be back right after. Anyway, have a break right after. We'll be back right after this interview, and talk to you for a few minutes, and then we'll put on Gene Lindland's interview.
Hello.
I am. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're always glad to have you.
What is that $4 billion article?
I just read an article on Acorn.
Yeah.
About they had a section in the stimulus packages. They're supposed to receive some money, but they're kind of a questionable organization.
Yeah, I mean, ever since 1970, all right, for the duration of 1970 till now, they've only gotten $53 million in government grants. Right, and now they're going to get $4 billion.
They might get $4 billion. I think that the cut that I was most concerned with was the cut to the states.
Right.
And you know, I'm rather taking that personally, Larry.
Well, you should, because what they are talking about would cost, in terms of the cuts, would cost Connecticut about $437 million. That's money that could be used towards stimulating our state and our town.
That's right.
So, what about Jody Rell's sweet cuts? She cut like 400 jobs, I think, or more.
There's certainly some interconnection there.
That's right.
And that was before she expected.
I'm taking it personally because AFSCME supported the Democratic Party and helped Obama get where he is. And it almost seems like, you know, the Republicans are directing it at us.
I couldn't agree more. You know, the problem is that, and if you listen to economists, actually on both sides of the aisle, we need a stimulus package. We need to get as much spending out in the economy as we can to
Absolutely.
Continue funding services, to create more jobs, to create more consumer confidence. Right now, we're kind of having this negative cascading effect, and we need to make it positive. We several of our unions sponsored an economic crisis forum yesterday in Hartford at the state capitol, and Representative Chris Murphy, who represents our district, including the towns and the Connecticut towns in your listenership,
That's right.
spoke about the need for the stimulus package, and a noted economist, and he's also a contributor to the New York Times, Robert Frank, talked very bluntly about the need to get money out into the economy and the need to make the pie larger for everyone. So this is not good. And what's happening in the Senate is that, you know, again, they've eliminated about $40 billion in aid to fiscally strapped states and other job-creating visions that were part of the version that passed the House. So, they're playing politics with people's jobs and with people's livelihoods and with the future of the economy.
Now, Dodd mentioned when I just caught a little bit of it, that there is another bill coming up that will give money to the states. Do you know anything about that?
I don't. Right now, I'm kind of, my understanding is sort of limited to the stimulus.
Okay. I couldn't find
so
anything.
So many different components, including...
Right. You know, I don't understand, Larry, why...
As well as Medicaid funding and
mm-hmm.
other provisions.
I don't know why they wouldn't want to... I mean, why would the Republicans be against helping the states?
I don't understand their thinking, except that it's a blow to ask me.
Well, no.
I think they're posturing for their right-wing conservative base.
Yep.
They couldn't... follow over each other fast enough when Bush was president to get the first stimulus bill out, and now all of a sudden,
I'll tell you,
have a spending bill, and they're calling it a mere spending bill.
But let me explain something. That I've got an article here that states that 20 states already have declared, have signed up to be, have declared their sovereignty in this country. All right, and they're going for sovereignty, and they want to move from the union. 20 of them already. And they're all red states, right? So I mean, we got the Civil War thing going on again, Bob. Only it's
Yeah, and you know, I mean, 20, I'm curious. I don't know what the motives are, but what I see happening is that certainly the Republicans are trying to recycle the same failed tactics, the same failed tax break for the wealthy, instead of creating jobs for the working and the middle class. So, you know, there's a lot at stake here. We need to create jobs. We need to have tax cuts for the middle class. We need to spend on infrastructure and other needs. There's just so much that has to happen, and it's wrapped up in this bill. Because, again, what do we want? We want an economy that works for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really that's the goal. So.
Yeah. What else did they cut out besides the they want to cut out the age of the states. They took a look at the reproduction in that area. And what other things were cut out that you think were a mistake?
I'm looking primarily at the fact that for the cuts that have been pushed in the Senate version of the bill, it's going to prevent for states that have budget shortfalls. There's funding for public safety, for health,
mm-hmm.
and welfare programs, and just the whole assortment of job training and other incentives. We need help on the unemployment insurance side of the issue. I think a majority of states are close to or have exhausted their unemployment insurance
mm-hmm.
funds. We need to get federal funds. So there have been a lot of cuts that really just, again, are going to put more stress on the states.
I was just going to mention this this article that was in the WorldNet Daily. It said lawmakers in 20 states moved to reclaim sovereignty. And what they're saying is that it says that as Obama's administration attempts to push through heavily toward advancing typically Democratic-supported social welfare programs, a rebellion against the growing dominance of federal control is beginning to spread at state levels. And they've got to mention Arizona, Hawaii, Montana, Michigan, Missouri, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, and Washington. And then they have, those are just the ones that have signed, and there's 20 of them that are ready to do it. So it doesn't look good. So I think I can understand why they're pulling away from the trillion-dollar deficit, the trillion-dollar bailout, because they don't want to burden anymore with it. But
the point is though that you need, again, the whole purpose behind the bailout is to the stimulus package is to get money out into the public sector so that we can create jobs, so that we can fund services. And then we can get the economy pumping again and increase people's buying power, increase their confidence. Look, it's pretty clear that the stimulus package that was championed by the Bush people
mm-hmm.
has not had the desired effect. But, fortunately we have a better class and a better group of people in the White House right now.
Well, if we get out of Iraq and we get out of Afghanistan, that'll cut the defense bill in half. Okay, and there's your money. Okay, so I think we know how to get out of this mess.
You just got to start spending
the money in the right way.
I can't disagree that the adventures that we're engaged in the Middle East are certainly not helping.
What's the problem? Is they're being written off, Larry. It's like that nobody is even, it's not even in the news anymore. It's barely in any news.
Thinking about that today, actually, that we haven't.
No, there hasn't been anything. And I read an article on the air December 31st. As of December 31st, okay, our agreement with the Maliki government, all right, was ended. We do not have any right under any treaty to be in Iraq now. All right, and George Bush wouldn't sign or ask for an extension. Okay, and wouldn't sign one. Right now, we are there illegally unless the Maliki government and Obama signed something, but there hasn't been anything mentioned about it. So I don't know. We shouldn't. It's an illegal war at this point.
From the beginning.
It's ironic that that Bush would want to make it illegal.
Foundation of lies.
He could be prosecuted under any international court for an undeclared war, all right? And
you know, still being an oppressive nation. I don't know. It's like, unless we get out of that mess, we're never going to get out of anything. I mean, it's just draining us. And
well, certainly there's, you know, when you talk about the fact that, you know, you got the Senate Republicans cutting $80 billion, primarily in, you know, aid to states, that yes,
yeah.
Perhaps we wouldn't be having these arguments.
No, that's right.
We certainly need to have aid to states to keep people employed, and that'll stimulate the economy. I don't think that's a really hard concept.
If you take away from the state of Connecticut, let's say 1,000 workers in Hartford, okay, crying out loud, Hartford restaurants and luncheonettes and convenience stores and everything else would have to be closed down.
As it is, there's
that's only 1,000 or maybe 2,000 employees.
And we're a small state.
Yeah.
And again, you know, when you ask what the cuts are, it's for instance, it's truly a would be a disastrous ripple effect. You know, my understanding, for instance, one of the Iowa Republican Charles Grassley put forward an amendment that would cut additional Medicaid funds to states that have been hit hardest by the recession. Now that would actually be one of the states that would lose tremendous Medicaid reimbursement funding under this amendment is our state. Grassley sponsored another amendment that would severely limit the ability of our state to manage the Medicaid program and increase pressure to cut other services, because if the money's not coming in and we have to make up for it somewhere else, obviously you're going to rob Peter to pay Paul.
And don't you think it's interesting that
Head Start is under danger, child care development block, there's a whole array of important services that are being threatened, and you know, what's that got to do with the small shop owner you just mentioned? Everything. Because if this negative trend continues, I think you kind of encapsulated it very nicely. There's not money coming into the state. There's not money circulating in the economy. We have fewer services. We have fewer jobs. People are going to be worse off. They're not going to spend money. Consumer confidence will plummet. And it will be felt by the small shop owner, you know, the coffee shop and the diner, the gas station. These are people who will feel the pain, and it doesn't have to happen.
But I love what people come on, the pundits come on TV, and they're outraged that CEOs will only receive $500,000 a year, Larry.
Yes.
Now, aren't you outraged at that?
Yeah, and they
they won't be able to get anybody to take a job for $500,000.
Yeah, and that's if they lose $500 million. Okay, they probably get a bonus. All right, if they make any money.
Right.
Now, when you do a lousy job, Larry, are you given a bonus?
I don't think so.
I know, I'm not.
The world is different from ours, you know.
You know, Obama's got the worst job in the world, right?
God, I think he does.
And he got the worst job in the world, and yet. I saw something in the papers today that they're the bankers and the people that he wants to cut their salaries.
Yeah.
They want him to cut his salary.
Right.
He's making $400,000 a year.
Right.
He's willing to pay him up to $500,000 a year, but they're telling him to cut his salary. All right. And I think it's more difficult to run a country than it is to run, you know, especially any corporation in America. You know.
And look, here's what's crazy. What he's proposing is just common sense. All the president is saying is that there ought to be restrictions on the compensation for senior executives at those firms that receive federal government assistance. And that's a fancy way of saying yours and my tax dollars.
Right.
You know? So, you know what? If you're not getting a dime of assistance from the state or federal government, fine. Determine whatever salary scale you want. All the president's saying, and I think it's about time somebody said, which is this, that you're not going to profiteer at the taxpayers' expense. And he's responding, the president, that is. I think it's this rising outrage against enormous payments, you know, often tens of millions of dollars to executives, as Lyle pointed, at corporations that have suffered multi-billion dollar losses. So what's so horrible about this? Nothing.
And they make you think that nobody's willing to take the job. Well, I think somebody who is capable maybe will take the job.
There's a lot of people
talented, laid off people in the financial services industry who would take take that in heart.
And maybe they weren't the ones that caused these companies to lose such an enormous amount of
exactly.
money.
Did you get
getting
a chance,
some new blood.
Did you get a chance to see the Treasury Secretary's interview?
Today.
Today?
Yes, I did.
What did you think of it?
A little bit of it actually tonight, yeah.
Mm. What did you think of it?
Well,
Be honest, Larry.
Beyond it, well, look, I'll still take the current crew we have now over what we just left office.
Up
to the nation.
Yeah. But, you know, the problem with this guy is, number one, I don't trust him. Number two, I mean, this is Geithner or whatever?
Yeah, Geithner.
Yeah. Geithner. I don't trust the guy, all right? And again, I don't... I'm sorry, I don't like the guy. He does, you know, every other word that he said was a cliche. Did you hear that? It was just a cliche.
Yeah.
One cliche after another.
He didn't really say anything of real substance.
No, it was one cliche after another.
I was disappointed.
You know, I was like, it's nothing. I mean,
I hope he brings us more later. But
yeah, I tell you, even George Bush gave you some fun, gave you a little humor there.
Right.
This guy just gives you one cliche after another.
Keep in mind, we are talking about the Treasury Secretary. There haven't been too many scintillating ones in recent memory.
I tell you, that Paulson was a piece of work, you know.
Well, and again, that's, you know, my point of comparison.
Did you know that Hank
Paulson? Only owned subsidiary of Lehman Brothers and all the big financial companies that got the money, so.
Did you know that his first job out of college was working for Ehrlichman in the Nixon administration? That was his first job. Worked there for 2 years under Ehrlichman, and his boss winds up going to jail.
Wow.
And he was a personal...
Ehrlichman, of course, was a henchman for Nixon. Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Alderman Ehrlichman. But Ehrlichman was the guy who got, I don't know how many years he got.
Yeah, I'm actually
passed away.
I'm reading a book now about...
I think he died this year or last year.
Mm-hmm.
Ehrlichman.
What are you reading, Larry?
Reading a book about, actually, we talk about Iraq, a book called Nixon Land.
Oh.
It's a fascinating book about how Nixon and his followers and advisors really used his presidency to kind of create the fracturing of an entire country. It's really fascinating stuff. You know, one of his early friends was Roger Ailes, who went on to found Fox News. And, you know, Ehrlichman, Haldeman, and they really went around the country just kind of fomenting hatred and... you know, helped create a lot of that.
Well, look at Colson. He's a holy man now, working in the prisons.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's had a huge...
A whole huge ministry.
In fact, George Bush...
love how they all find God.
Yeah.
No, his faith-based initiative, remember that? I mean, the people already almost forget Mr. Bush's faith-based initiative. Wound up giving Colson some mega millions of dollars.
Wow.
That was his little personal stimulus
back. Oh, he's got a prison mission, you know?
Yeah.
And, so I don't know.
Along with the 1,000 points of light or whatever it was they were doing.
Yeah, none of those programs never were.
No, they never. That was just gift money to friends.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Oh, yeah.
You, well said.
That's right.
That's all it was.
And you wonder why Bill Clinton is so successful getting international monies. You wonder how many favors they owed him.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's like...
I've said this before. I think...
How does a guy go from 600,000 net worth when he left office to 150 net worth?
Well,
150 million net worth inside of, what, 8 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, wait to see what happens with Bush and how he cashes in.
Do you think anybody really want him to speak? I don't think so.
Oh, he's planning to make money.
But of course, there's family money anyway. So,
yeah.
No, you hope he just goes away.
My fear is that they'll dredge up Jed and try to prop him up and put him out there.
Well, of course, the old man is talking about Jeb Bush. So.
Yeah.
We can't do that. We can't soil the
hollow ground
of these people.
I just couldn't stand it. I just couldn't. I hope that doesn't happen.
So what do you think about Jody Babes?
I think you guys probably seeing our emails and information pages.
Yeah.
Very underwhelming. You know, that's being kind. It just, her budget, you know, is actually going to play into the disaster economics that we're seeing. Not simply that she wants to cut 400 jobs. She wants to eliminate 23 agencies, including agencies that do a heck of a lot of good things for the public.
There was one I saw on the news the other night when she had her budget cuts, and it was the women and it was a women and children's advocacy agency.
Yeah, the permanent commission on the status of women.
Yeah. She cut that all out, right?
She's proposing to eliminate that. She's proposing to eliminate the healthcare advocate's office, and that's actually an independent person who's independent of the insurance industry. That's
right.
Provided a tremendous help to consumers in their fights against big insurance companies. So, you know, that's a bow to her backers and controllers in the insurance industry. She wants to eliminate the consumer council office. So, no surprise. I mean, she's getting rid of watchdog agencies. I think one of the most reprehensible cuts she's proposing, she wants to close down Cedar Crest Hospital, a state hospital, for adults with a whole range of mental health issues, and she wants to close a facility in Hamden.
What is she going to do with
that? High Meadows State Facility.
But what will she do with those people?
And that takes care of children with mental health, serious mental health problems. And parents are so upset who use High Meadows, and the state has no plan for what they're going to do for those kids. They'll say they'll, you know, pay for them to go to other facilities. But
what about the adults?
Right. Well, again, you know, you're asking for logic, you know, and all the governor's doing is cutting and making things worse. So we've summarized it that at a time when Connecticut needed a life preserver, she threw us an anchor.
Oh God, It's really sick.
So, you know, I would urge you guys and your listeners to stay on top of it. You can certainly do it through our website. What she proposed is obviously going to be radically different at the time that the legislature gets down to the business of trying to figure all this out. So,
what kind of feelings do you have now? Do they feel like they're going to be successful here?
It's so early. It's difficult to say. We, our state, on our state employee union coalition, we commissioned a poll of 600 Connecticut residents and actually found some very interesting findings, which were primarily that people don't want to see public services reduced or cut or eliminated, and people do want to see more justice in our tax system, meaning more progressivity in the income tax and closing the corporate loopholes that basically allow, say, a beautician to pay more in taxes than some of our largest corporations.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a great state to be in, and I never begrudge anyone their wealth. This is a great state to house your corporation in. It's a great state to enjoy your wealth in. So, you know, we have to have a fundamental argument about what's fair and right and proper in this state if we're going to pull ourselves out of this.
That's
you
true.
Can't cut your way out of the mess we're in.
Listen, I was going to ask you...
have something that's far worse in the end.
I was going to ask you what you thought about California. Here it says about California prepares to stop paying bills. Okay, there's a February 1st.
Yeah.
They're just not going to have
any
money.
They're in
money.
A horrible position.
They're about ready to give out. They're going to
Schwarzenegger doesn't help it with his heavy-handed behavior either.
No.
No, they're planning to give IOUs.
Right.
IOUs to people.
I hope they don't plan to give that to state employees.
State employees, but entitlement.
Notorious for his attacks on working people in California, so I think that's exactly what you're going to see. And you know, in some ways, it's a reflection of what's happening across the country. Services and jobs are being cut, and crises are just emerging at every level. So it kind of brings us back to the fact that we need to have a stimulus bill. It needs to be a big bill.
Mm-hmm.
Big bill that puts money out into all of the state and local economies so that public education programs are funded, so that our schools stay open, so that construction can continue, so that our bridges don't collapse, that
that's how we're going to get through this crisis.
I don't know why. For some reason, the Republicans don't seem to want to go for the infrastructure. They don't think that's a stimulus.
I don't understand the thinking on that.
If you had mass transportation, if you had...
Stimulus is to cut taxes for the wealthy and to allow corporations to continue setting jobs offshore set up tax shelters in other countries. That's their stimulus package, is for the elite who are already benefiting and, are not suffering. And we have to change the direction of this country if we're going to
General Motors.
We see the president propose that limit on executive compensation. We have to start changing the dialogue to the fact that we're all in this together.
Lila just saw General Motors was shutting down plants here.
Pratt and Whitney, of course, they're building a large plant in Singapore this second.
Really?
That was on the news yesterday.
That's not helping Connecticut.
No, that's not helping
Connecticut. They already said they were dropping 5,000 jobs or 10,000 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They just announced it.
Well, that's GM, correct?
Pratt & Whitney.
Mm-hmm.
Pratt & Whitney was laying off 5,000 jobs.
This is what's going on in the economy. But again, so we can try to make things better through public policy, or we can make things worse. We're really, we're at that point. We're at the precipice. We have to make some really profound decisions about what we do, and we have to do it in a way that, gets us out of this mess and puts us in a better place. And it's going to take a long time.
The voters signal that they want change, and I think in order to do it, you can't sort of do it by halves. You have to really push for the whole thing.
Right.
Because it will fail. It'll be lukewarm. It won't do what it needs to do. We really need to, if we're going to have a stimulus package, then it needs to really have teeth in it.
Let's just get it done, in the right way.
That's right. I agree.
And I don't think teeth are in giving it to Acorn, okay? And I don't think teeth are giving $4 billion to Acorn or giving whatever. Do you remember the last $350 billion that Bush gave out?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember how they said they porked that thing up like crazy?
Right.
I remember they gave Democratic or Republican guys $250 million for road construction in their state. They gave another guy this and another guy that. So they porked it all up. So they made it totally delectable for everybody to vote for it without even reading the damn thing. Okay. So what they did is this one is an austere $350 billion. You know what I mean?
Right.
They're not getting all the perks.
That's because it's really targeted at the people who need it.
Right, exactly. So now they're going to make sure that the people don't get bailouts. Banks. It's just absurd. It's an absurd.
Hope that the next time we talk, it's in a better, we're in a better direction. We'll see.
Well, the Senate passed it today, so hopefully it'll be a...
Well, then what they do is they kind of get together and hammer out between them.
They have to have a conference and try to hammer it, like you said.
It's no more date. There's no more debate, though, on it, so that's
but,
a good thing.
It's passed, and now they have to really, get together and present it in a unified way.
They do have the votes in the House to pass this thing, don't they?
Yes.
Yeah, they do.
And again, the House version was a more comprehensive and
much more.
I guess it was going to put more money out into the economy. So we'll see.
Then I hope that's the one that prevails.
Me too.
Yeah, I really do, and I
gotta get moving forward.
Oh, absolutely. And people are getting desperate, and they're so scared. When I talk to people, they really feel scared, and a lot of people have lost their jobs.
People are losing their jobs. Stores are closing. We are in a crisis, and it's an economic crisis, and it requires really bold and creative long-term solutions that will...
We know you guys will find a way.
Yes.
Yes, hopefully we can help you with that.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Yeah, so, Larry, I know you got to get going, but we want to thank you so much for being on.
Thank you.
And we want everybody to go to council4.org for all the updates.
Please.
And is there anything big you got coming up that you want people to know about?
We'll have a lot of activities coming up, most notably on March 25th at noon in Hartford. We're going to have a big rally in downtown Hartford regarding the governor's budget cuts service cuts. So stay tuned to our website for that and a whole lot of other good things.
All right,
well, that's good to know about, and I hope the folks at home decide to go out to that.
Good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Larry.
Guys, I'll talk to you soon.
Good
night.
That was Larry Dorman talking to us from from his home. Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and it's 9 o'clock. Leo, station ID. Council4.org.
Yeah, Council4.org. And this is WQQQ 103.3 FM in Sharon, Lakeville, and Millerton. You're listening to the LA Steel Show. And we just got off the line with Larry Dorman, the Public Affairs Coordinator for the AFSCME Union. AFSCME, by the way, happens to be the largest Democratic donor in the country, in the country, not the state, the country. And hopefully they're out there, they're getting their money's worth. I don't know, but we're hoping they do, and all the union people. With AFSCME and other unions. I wanted to mention our guest tonight coming up at 9:30 is Jean Levlin, and she is she's an author of five different books. She's a vegetarian cook, vegetarian chef, and
she taught cooking at the New School for Social Research in New York.
And she's nice lady, and we're going to talk to her coming up at 9:30. But between now and 9:30, we usually have Woody's sports page and so on. Woody won't be with us tonight, so we wanted to. I think we're going to start our musical thing early. What do you think?
Okay, go right ahead.
And then we'll to come back and we'll read some
we
stuff.
We a couple hours.
And then we'll have our guest. And,
okay.
Let's see. Tonight I've got a couple of back-to-backs.
So what do you have?
I don't know. I don't know why I was feeling like this. I was feeling like this. And I wanted to hear a couple of tunes. Two tunes. Two are the same, but they're done by different artists. But they're the best out. They're the best ever renditions of these.
Oh.
All right, so,
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, and I got them set up back-to-back. And I got a couple other things. So stay with us. You guys got a few songs, and we'll be back with a few articles and author, cookbook recipe author, Jean Levlin, vegetarian classics, how to cook vegetarian, how to find your stuff, vegetarian stuff, and how to get all your vegetarian things into your groove. So we're going to talk about that tonight. So join us. In a minute, we're going to set you off with a great song. There we go.
Thank you. light. He said, come here, step into the light. He said, yeah, you're right. You want to tell a second mother this is
right. My reflection, he says, is much too well.
And Lila, you wanted to read
something
on the U.S. That was a real important article, and I have one here that's another one
that you're going to follow up with?
Yeah.
Okay. This is from the World Net Daily, and by Chelsea Schilling. A United Nations human rights treaty that could prohibit children from being spanked or homeschooled, ban youngsters from facing the death penalty, and forbid parents from deciding their family's religion is on America's doorstep, a legal expert warns. Michael Ferris of Percival, Virginia, is president of parentalrights.org, chairman of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, and chancellor of Patrick Henry College. He told WND that under the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, every decision a parent makes can be reviewed by the government to determine whether it is in the child's best interest. The 1990s-era document was ratified quickly by 193 nations worldwide, but not the United States or Somalia. In Somalia, there was no recognized government to do the formal recognition. In the United States, there's been opposition to its power. Countries that ratify the treaty are bound to it by international law. Although signed by Madeleine Albright, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, on February 16, 1995, the U.S. Senate never ratified the treaty, largely because of conservatives' efforts to point out it would create the list of rights which primarily would be enforced against parents. The international treaty creates specific civil, economic, social, cultural, and even economic rights for every child, and states that the best interests of the child shall be a primary consideration. While the treaty states that parents or legal guardians have primary responsibility for the upbringing and development of the child, Ferris said government will ultimately determine whether parents' decisions are in the children's best interest. The treaty is monitored by the CRC. Enforcement powers. According to the Parental Rights website, the substance of the CRC dictates the following. Parents would no longer be able to administer reasonable spankings to their children. A murderer aged 17 years, 11 months, and 28 and 9 days at the time of his crime could no longer be sentenced to life in prison. Children would have the ability to choose their own religion, while parents would only have the authority to give their children advice about religion. The best interest of the child principle would give the government the ability to override every decision made by every parent if a government worker disagreed with the parent's decision. A child's right to be heard would follow him or her to seek governmental review of every parental decision with which the child disagreed. According to existing interpretation, it would be illegal for a nation to spend more on national defense than it does on child's welfare. On children's welfare, excuse me. Children would acquire a legally enforceable right to leisure. Teaching children about Christianity in schools has been held to be out of compliance with the CRC. Allowing parents to opt their children out of sex education has been held to be out of compliance with the CRC. Children would have the right to reproductive health information and services, including abortions, without parental knowledge or consent. When the child has a right fulfilled by the government, the responsibilities shift from the parents to the government, Ferris said. This implication of all the shifting of responsibilities is that parents no longer have the traditional roles of either being responsible for their children or having the right to direct their children. The government would decide what is in the best interest of children in every case, and the CRC would be considered superior to state laws, Ferris said. Parents could be treated like criminals for everyday decisions about their children's lives. Let's see what it says here in the last paragraph. It kind of goes on a bit. Michael Ferris says social workers would be the ones responsible for implementation of the policies. Ferris said it would be easier for President Obama to push for ratification of the treaty than it was for the Clinton administration because the political world has changed. At a Walden University presidential debate last October, Obama indicated he may take action.
Personally, I can't see. He's got two kids. He lives in a fishbowl. Mm-hmm. I can't for any way see that he would, you know, why would he want to go through this, an insane act like that?
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been a strong supporter.
Hillary Clinton's a strong supporter of it.
She now has direct control over the treaty submission to the Senate for ratification.
She's a mummy theorist, though.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The process requires a 2/3 vote. That's interesting. I didn't even know they had
such a couple more minutes.
Those
two other articles I wanted to bring up. One was the genetic mapping of babies by 2019 will transform preventive medicine. Every baby born born a decade from now will have his genetic code mapped at birth. The head of the world's leading genome sequencing company has predicted a complete DNA readout of every newborn will be technically feasible and affordable in less than 5 years, and promising a revolution in healthcare. The only social and legal issues are likely to delay the era of genome sequences are genetic profiles. For all, by 2019, it will have become routine to map infants' genes when they are born, Dr. Flatley told The Times. This is from The Times Online. This will open a new approach to medicine, by which conditions such as diabetes, heart disease can be predicted and prevented, and drugs treatment more safely and effectively. Well, the thing with this is that really bothers me is you can detect these things now. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, does your father have it? Does your mother have it? Does your sister have it? Is it in your family? You know, 9 out of 10 times, you might get it. Okay.
Probably excludes you from some kind of medical coverage.
Yeah, that's what it is. I mean, they're going to pay that short and drop you like a ton of brick. So it's going to have to go to universal health care because the insurance companies are planning to dump everybody anyway. And one more thing, MMR vaccine, no jab, no school. As measles cases in the UK hit a high record, Joanna Walters reports from the US where unvaccinated children are barred from school and their parents could face jail. Also in the US, parents in the US are not simply advised by the health authorities to get their children vaccinated against measles, they are obliged to do it. Children who do not have, or children who have not been immunized face a no jab, no school exclusion. From daycare, nursery, and school. In extreme cases, their parents have been threatened with fines and jail. In other cases, parents have been paid $50 a time to explain. Parents have been paid $50 a time to explain to researchers why they are in the tiny minority that are so reluctant to vaccinate their children. In studies probing parents' lingering fears of links between measles, mumps, and rubella. And autism, asthma, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It also, we found that these vaccines cause cancer. All right, they are what cause cancer. And over the next few months, parents of toddlers across the U.S. will begin registering their children for kindergarten and infant school in September. Schools restrict posts. Districts post their registration rules. Yeah, I mean, most of your schools in this country post their registration rules and make sure that they have all their shots. But I don't know. It's it's going to become a mandatory thing here, and pretty weird. Okay, I'm going to call our guest and we'll be right back. And Lila's going to introduce her.
Leo's going to call Jean Lemlin, and she's the author of Vegetarian Classics. 300 essential and easy recipes for every meal. And Jean Lemlin sets the standard for accessible and appealing vegetarian cooking. Vegetarian Classics is Jean's most useful and comprehensive book to date. An essential collection of 300 no-fail recipes for soups, salads, sandwiches, pastas, pizzas, calzones, casseroles, stir-fries, stovetop dishes, sides, snacks, desserts, and breakfast. Each recipe is deeply satisfying and surprisingly simple. And that's true. I looked at some of the recipes and I thought, oh, I could do this. And actually, before Jean had given us her vegetarian classic, we had snuck off to the library and already taken a look at quick vegetarian pleasures.
Hi, Jean.
Hi, Jean. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hi. Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. We're glad to have you. And I was just sharing with the folks at home that before you sent us vegetarian classics, we had zipped over to our local library, and there you were, quick vegetarian pleasures.
Oh. That's the book that won the James Beard Award. That's probably my biggest seller.
Yes, and you know what? I was looking through it, and I've looked at many vegetarian cookbooks, but this one is wonderful.
Thank you.
And I said,
it seems like when people see that word quick on there, too, their hand goes right out and they grab it.
Oh, yes, in our busy lives, we hardly have time for cooking or anything.
And I was grateful that you gave us the...
vegetarian classes.
Quick, yeah, but 300 quick and easy.
Yeah, we want the easy, too.
and I heard that was a very good seller as well.
Yeah, they are all selling quite well. I'm fortunate in that regard. Easiness, that's so important. I think, especially with vegetarian food,
People
think of it as being something much more time-consuming and that you have to rearrange your kitchen and approach it all differently, and I really try to demystify it because everybody's so busy and they don't want to spend a lot of time looking for unusual ingredients. They want to cook with things they can get easily in the supermarkets, and so that's really been my whole approach.
Right.
Well, you can see that, and of course, I have a sweet tooth, so I immediately went to the back where it said desserts. I always go to the back and go forward.
I'm not a purist. You know, there are some vegetarians who don't eat any sugar and only use whole grains. I'm not in that category. I think I'm what's called a relaxed vegetarian. I don't eat meat, but I don't feel like every meal has to be this perfect nutritional model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as you eat a lot of healthful foods, what's the big deal if you have a cake that has some sugar in it and butter? It's good for you.
Oh, sure. How long have you been a vegetarian? How did you get into cooking?
About 35 years.
Oh, wow. You were a kid then.
I was a kid. I saw a movie once on slaughterhouses.
Ooh.
And I read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, probably both in the same year. And ever since then, I just never felt comfortable about eating meat. And I try not to be dogmatic about it. I understand that people have different ideas about diets and how to approach things, and so I think that's important to respect that. But for me, it just never made sense to eat meat when there's so much other food available, and it was from an ethical standpoint. I just was not comfortable about the suffering of animals. The health part was secondary.
Okay. Now, do you have you have a family, obviously, and are they also vegetarian, or do you cook both?
Yes, they all are.
They all are. So that makes it easy.
And my son's an athlete too, which is interesting because he plays basketball in college, and they're always surprised because he's very into working out and.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very rigorous sport, and he's been fine being vegetarian. It's just, you know, the diet has not hindered him in any way.
So does he find it easy to get vegetarian meals while he's away, or do you have to send him care packages?
Oh, no, I don't send him care packages. Those days are gone. He does fine. Food in the United States has changed so dramatically in the last 20 years. You can go and get vegetarian food in almost any restaurant. Now, it's not all top quality, but they're aware of it now, that there are people out there who don't eat meat, and there are, you know, over 30 million vegetarians now, they say, in the United States. And then there was also this whole group of people who they might eat meat, but they like to skip it a couple of times a week.
Yeah.
So that adds to the pool. So now it seems like it's not that hard to go to restaurants and find decent vegetarian food.
And I think that's the category that I'm in.
Yeah, there's a lot of people like that. And that's my book, so I try to appeal to people who like to eat meat but want to skip it, and so they don't really want really esoteric food or difficult to find ingredients. They want to easily put together a meatless meal that feels familiar to them.
That's why your cookbooks are so appealing.
Thank you.
Because when I said I could do this, I have these ingredients and I can work with it, and they look very tasty too.
I've been reading the coconut cake recipe here for the last 5 minutes.
That's a good one.
Is it? Yeah. I like coconut and I like coconut cake. But, you know, I was looking to see if they had the coconut cake was in the, after coconut in the cake itself, not just on top of it. But this one, it's just on top. It's really just a white cake, right?
It's a white cake, right, but it has a strong coconut flavor when you eat that.
Really?
You put it in, you can throw it inside. It actually wouldn't hurt the cake. I don't like the texture as much. I think that's why usually when they make coconut cake, they put it between the layers with icing.
Yeah.
But, you know, you still could do it. It would be fine.
Yeah, I love coconut cake. I like coconut pie, too. I noticed you got great cheesecakes in here, too.
Yeah, I have some cheesecake. Yeah, this is a white chocolate and raspberry cheesecake.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
That's great.
I don't eat dessert a lot,
right.
But when I do eat it, I want it to be really good. So something like that cheesecake, you can make it, stick it in the freezer,
yeah.
every, you know, maybe once a week, take out a couple of slices and wrap it up and put it back in, and it still will be great.
That's not going to happen. And, you know, yeah, you know that's not going to happen. Maybe two nights, you know, would be good. But it says white chocolate and raspberry cheesecake, and it's two sensational flavors of white chocolate and raspberry come together to create a seductive cheesecake. As in classic cheesecake, preceding recipe, beating as little air as possible to the barrier will produce a memorable satiny creaminess. Oh, wow, that's the secret, huh?
It is. You know, I like to put in a lot of things about chemistry and cooking techniques in my recipes because I'm kind of a fanatical tester. I'll test something and test it again and test it again, and then I realize that the important thing is to just put all that information in, especially in little side notes in the recipes, to let people know what will happen if you beat something too long or you don't beat it enough. And I think that's the fun part, putting in the technical stuff.
Yeah, because it makes the cookbook very readable and a bit entertaining.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. I enjoy
reading. But, you know, there's so many people who love to read cookbooks in bed at night.
Yeah.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Oh, gosh, there are a lot of people like that. And so I think it's important to have a lot of text and interesting headnotes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I noticed one thing about this. I was looking at the ingredients for that cheesecake, and I was just looking at 6 ounces of white chocolate. That's quite a bit, isn't it?
Yeah, but the cheesecake is quite big.
It's big.
Oh, yeah, you're going to be able to get a lot of servings out of it. In fact, it's the perfect dessert for a party because it doesn't really take long to make, and you can serve 14 people, 16 people if you wanted.
Wow, with one of these, one cake?
Oh, yeah, it's rich.
Oh,
yeah, you would only have a little bit.
You only need a little bit, that's right.
And you top it with sour cream.
A thin, thin layer. That's because the top of cheesecake will crack when you bake it.
Oh,
so you put this thin layer of sour cream on top, and not only does it give this nice contrast and texture, but it also covers up any imperfections on the top. So that's a really good thing to do with cheesecake.
That's good. I'm glad that's a good tip.
I noticed that somebody in one of the printouts you gave us that someone had commented that you prove that tofu can be a good thing. Whenever I look at it, it's sort of unappetizing and, as they said, wobbly and flavorless. But you prove with dishes like pad thai and crispy tofu and roasted tofu salad that it can be a good thing. I'm looking forward to
trying it. That's one of my major accomplishments, I feel. I discovered this method of roasting tofu.
Really?
And tofu is a bland food, so it really needs a lot of flavor around it so it can absorb it. But it's the texture that oftentimes turns off people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I discovered, I was experimenting one day in the kitchen. I got extra firm tofu and sliced it and patted it very, very dry, cut it into cubes, and then just tossed it with some soy sauce and sesame oil and laid it on a pan and stuck it in the oven 400 degrees for a half hour. And it came out really crispy on the outside and glistening, and it was delicious hot, but then I let it sit for a bit and tasted it cold, and it was equally as good. So I've been putting it in salads and stuff, but it's amazing how the tofu gets transformed by roasting it.
Well, you're very clever.
Well, after 5 cookbooks, you know, it's so important to start making it, keep it interesting for yourself, you know. After, I think it's counted one day, it's like 975 recipes I've done, so.
Wow.
I don't want to repeat myself, so it just started to become fun to experiment, and that's what I got.
How did you get into cooking?
When I was in high school, I lived in a house, my mother was a single parent, and we had 4 children, because my father died when I was an infant, and so I was a latchkey child. I used to come home from school. My mother was at work. And I just play around in the kitchen and start cooking. And fortunately, she was the kind of person who gave me some space and let me do stuff in the kitchen. She wasn't complaining about things being a mess. And when I became a vegetarian, I had to actually look into preparing things for myself. And so I would experiment, and she'd come home and be all happy about things I made. So that was really nice to have that kind of support. And I just thought I loved it. It was a time when the United States was getting exposed to all kinds of ethnic cuisines.
Mm-hmm.
And because the food before had been terrible, you know, just basically a meat and potato diet.
Yeah,
this whole world of international cooking opened up, and I still loved to fool around and try all these different flavors. And it was just plain fun. That's how I got interested in it. I loved doing it. And then when I went to college and I majored in art history and I studied psychology and all that, but I would come home, all I would want to do was cook. And someone said to me, you're looking for this vocation in life, but it's so obvious what it is for you. It's all you want to do is cook, and I thought, well, yeah, but what can I do with it? So then I started teaching cooking, and I started writing recipes down, and my husband had said to me, why do you cook other people's recipes? Why don't you create stuff yourself? And I remember being so insulted when he said that, because I thought, well, whoever just makes up recipes. But then I thought, well, maybe I should try that. And I kept a notebook in the kitchen and started recording everything I did in detail. And before you knew it, I had a collection of them, and I put together a manuscript and sent it out. And someone, actually, Knopf was the first publishing company that took my first book. And then it just kind of snowballed. But it was really almost like an obsession. I loved being in the kitchen.
Have you ever thought of opening a restaurant? Or?
Oh, God, I tried. I've explored every fantasy there is with food, and the restaurant one is just, it's a hard, hard profession. You work nights, you work weekends, you work in the summer, you work on holidays. It's hot, all of those things. I thought maybe that would kill cooking for me.
I
loved being in the kitchen, and I loved writing.
You combined the two very successfully, which is great.
I was fortunate to be able to do that. Catering, I find exhausting. It's the pressure is hard. Restaurant work, there aren't a lot of choices with cooking.
All right, now here's something that I think you should talk to a licensor about and get it into the frozen food sections, right? It's something like portobello mushroom pate. Now that turns me on.
Yeah.
And so does roasted eggplant caviar. Those are two veggies that I really like.
Yeah, I thought of that too, the marketing angle. I used to collect all articles about that, and I considered doing that, going into creating a product, but...
Well, you got it right here. You can just
bring it
up. The
business angle wasn't, well, I don't know. I just didn't pursue it.
I mean, if I was walking around the Stop and Shop or something and I saw portobello mushroom pate in there, okay, for, I don't know, $3.99, $4.99, whatever it would be for a thing.
Right.
Well, you know, Lila said that things it's going to be more, but if I saw it for whatever, and I would, you know, with the ingredients that are in here, I would be willing to pick that up. I'd love to pick it up. And roasted eggplant caviar, that's a really poor man's caviar.
Yeah, poor man's caviar. That's an old Russian classic.
Like that looks really good, though. Tomatoes cored with horizontal in half. With tomatoes, green peppers, onions, garlic, cloves, and where's the eggplants in here? Oh, 1.5 or 2 pound eggplant, half. And you roast this thing up, right?
That's right. You roast it all in the oven, and then you mash it and kind of puree it and serve it on toast. Crostini or something. It's just
really
fabulous.
Really good, huh?
Now, do you have a favorite recipe yourself that you like to serve, say, we have Valentine's Day coming up. What would be the perfect vegetarian Valentine's Day dinner? What do you think?
Well, I guess, you know, I love curry.
I love Indian food.
I've always liked it. And I have a couple of vegetarian curries made with coconut milk so that the flavor of the sauce is really rich. The coconut milk was, and I don't just use curry powder, I'll use things like cumin and cayenne and turmeric and coriander, the spices that...
Yeah, those are all good.
Yeah, that make up curry powder. And I might consider that having a somewhat of an Indian meal, vegetable curry with rice. And that way, see, if I eat something like that's not too rich, then the cheesecake, now that would go well with it. It's all about balance.
Yeah, I think
that sounds pretty good.
Yeah. I also have sometimes make polenta dishes. Like, I'll cook polenta with some cheese in it and spread it out on a baking sheet to get firm, and then cut it into triangles, and then brush it lightly with oil and bake it, so that it's really crispy on the outside and kind of creamy and cheesy inside. And then you can serve two of those crispy triangles on a plate and then top it with a nice sauce made with mixed mushrooms with garlic and tomatoes or something. And that can look really pretty because you have the bright yellow polenta squares and this red and brown sauce on top, fresh basil or something on it. And that can be quite elegant.
I never found polenta to be too flavor. I've probably never cooked it right.
Well, it's another item that kind of takes on the flavor of other things, don't you think?
Yeah, well, if you put a good Parmesan cheese in it, it should taste really, that have a nutty, buttery flavor.
Oh, okay.
I just use regular cornmeal, Quaker Oat cornmeal. I don't buy special cornmeal for it because, again, I want it to be quick. I can make a polenta dinner in about 12 minutes. Boil water, slowly whisk in the cornmeal, keep whisking it. It cooks in maybe 3 minutes or so, 4 minutes. Take it off the pot. I throw in maybe some Parmesan cheese and some goat cheese. Spoon it onto my plate and then have some kind of sautéed vegetable, like maybe zucchini with tomatoes or something. Put that on top and that's dinner. And it is so good. But again, you want to have a nice, flavorful cheese in it. You don't need a lot of it, but...
I mean, I do a lot of grilling in the summer, and I got into doing some vegetables and stuff. I really like grilled vegetables, but what would be something that you would recommend? I found zucchini is to be very good grilled.
Yeah, and red peppers, of course,
red
are really good.
Grilled, yeah.
And you can do eggplant, too.
I wanted to ask you, I never grilled an eggplant.
Oh, that's great. You just slice it into discs,
yeah.
And then brush it with olive oil,
uh-huh.
And you can put... salt and pepper on it, but you don't really need much more than that, and it takes on that charcoal flavor. It's delicious.
Oh, all right.
So you could grill eggplant. Sometimes I grill pizzas. I like to make,
oh.
I'll get a roll out some store-bought pizza dough,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And into manageable sizes. You don't want a big piece of dough for the grill,
right.
So maybe like individual pizzas. And you pre-cook the crust on the grill, like 2 minutes on one side, flip it over, two
oh.
minutes on the other side,
yeah,
and then put your toppings on. Cover the grill, and you've got a nice grilled pizza. Has to be low heat, though. It can't.
Yeah.
The crust will burn if it's very high.
How long do you cook it for?
Three or four minutes.
Three
you can
four.
See because now that the crust has been pre-cooked, it's really just a matter of melting the toppings.
Okay.
So, but you just don't want it to be very high heat.
Yeah, and you don't want to burn. But once you've crusted the dough. Doesn't you risk it burning after a couple of minutes?
Well, yeah, sometimes those grills have two levels. I'll put it on the higher level if
yeah.
it's one of those type of grills.
Oh, you put it on the high level, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got one of those, yeah.
Right, and that will work well. That's a good thing to do.
Okay.
And then sometimes I'll do like kebabs, you know, it's
yeah.
firm tofu that's been marinated and different kind of vegetables, and I'll grill those.
What do you put in your pizza?
My pizza,
yeah,
probably my favorite thing. I love anything tomatoey, so I'll probably put some fresh tomatoes. Pesto is a good thing. Oh, and lately my favorite thing has been, I know this is going to sound strange to you, but potato pizza.
Potato
Ooh.
Pizza?
It is so delicious. You have a pizza crust, and then you spread pesto on the crust. Thinly sliced cooked potato on top of that, and Parmesan cheese on the top. And there's something about the way the potatoes soak up the garlic.
Mm.
Oh my God, it is so delicious. And you can put tomato too. You can do it with garlic and tomatoes and potatoes. I had once a focaccia a couple of years ago, which is like, you know, that chewy Tuscan bread, and it had diced potato and sliced onion on top with a little bit of tomatoes and rosemary. It was so delicious, and then I came home and started fooling around with pizzas, and every time I make it, people go, oh, my God, this is so good, I can't believe it. The potato gets transformed, like it becomes almost like a sponge for the flavors.
Wow.
It's delicious.
So you boil them, you cut them up thin, and...
And pre-cook them.
Pre-cook
them. Have to be pre-cooked.
Any particular...
And then you put some kind of garlicky base. It can be pesto, or it can be tomato and a little sautéed garlic or something. Put some potatoes on top, a little bit of cheese on top of that, and then cook it. So it's like a golden on top.
Wow.
And it comes out great.
It comes out great. It's a great flavor.
Oh,
well,
great.
We're going to try that.
Yeah.
does that work if you put it in the, like if you grill it in little sizes too?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it turns out just as well, right?
Yes. It's delicious. It's,
okay.
I guess there's some recipes in Italy where they'll mix... like what they call trinette, but it's like almost like a fettuccine with green beans, pesto, and diced potatoes. It's a traditional dish that's been around for years. And I used to read about it, and I thought, two starches? How could you mix potatoes with pasta? It just seems so bizarre.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
Common here. It is a delicious dish.
Potatoes.
It's just doesn't dominate the dish, but just a little, you know, some diced potatoes, green beans, and pesto on this pasta. Fabulous combination. So I guess there is some... history to those flavors being together.
Now, since you're...
Lila makes a nice pesto.
Oh, thank you.
You make a nice pesto she does that. It's real good.
Now, you're into all different kinds of vegetables. Do you also garden as well? Are you into that aspect of being a vegetarian?
Yeah, I don't have a big garden. I couldn't manage taking care of it with writing. It was just too much for me, but always have fresh herbs, tomatoes. I gardened a lot more years ago. I've been doing it less and less, but my intention is to come back to it more.
Do you do your herb gardens in the do you do it outside or do you have it
outside? Oh yeah, outside.
Yeah.
Well, that's always a nice thing to have fresh herbs.
What do you find to be the most, that you use the most, or most common that you use?
Probably basil, because I make so much pesto.
Oh, really?
A fresh basil. I like in the summertime, I have a lot of dishes where I don't have to cook.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, say, certain types of marinated salads. I'll get chickpeas and rinse them off in a strainer and put them in a bowl.
Yeah.
And I'll add diced fresh tomatoes, like a vinaigrette dressing, shredded basil. You can add almost anything to it. You could add pasta to it, too, if you want. But it's a marinated salad, you know, that's substantial enough to be like a main course on a hot summer day with some crusty French bread.
I love, we grow basil and hot peppers and
a few
other things which out there. Lettuce, we've had lettuce.
Parsley, and
Lila grows them on our patio in big pots.
Yeah, big pots, they do well.
Yeah, they do.
And my new favorite thing, too, I love cilantro.
Oh, yes.
I developed a great flavor, but every time I grow it, it turns to seed so quickly.
Oh.
And every time I buy it, I don't use it enough. So I tried this one trick, and boy, it has become one of my favorite things to do. You're going to laugh when you hear it, but I get a bunch of cilantro from the market, and I wash it and spin it dry, you know, pat it as much as I can. I put it in the blender with a little bit of olive oil and a little splash of vinegar and totally puree it and pour it in like a plastic deli container, and it maybe fills up the deli container a third of the way or something. I stick it in the freezer, and it gets frozen. When I need cilantro for Mexican food or Indian food or whatever, I take out the container, invert it, and knock out, it's like a disc now, a frozen disc. You knock it out, and I quickly get a potato peeler and shave off all this cilantro puree all over the top of something, and it melts in a second, and it has a really bright, fresh flavor, of just like it's fresh cilantro. It doesn't taste like something fried or frozen. And then I just stick the disc back in the plastic container and keep it in the freezer. So I always have cilantro here in the house.
Well, you're very clever. Very clever.
It's fun, you know.
How do you, like, crazy, you have that. One thing that we're trying to figure out, like, we grow tomatoes as well, and, but, you know, tomatoes are really sensitive to light, and it's difficult. But
they need a lot of sun.
Yeah. What do you find to be, like, you always get, like, the regular tomato, you know, whatever the garden side tomato is. But as far as cooking-wise, what's one of the best tomatoes to try to grow? Or to have, or to buy?
Well, for cooking, plum tomatoes are the best just because they have less liquid in them. But, you know, if you like to have tomato sandwiches, my husband and I love to have open-faced tomato sandwiches in the summer. So that's a totally different kind of tomato. We'll get some kind of bread and toast it, and then mayonnaise on it, and then cover the top with tomatoes and salt and pepper, and that's it.
Oh.
And we love those open-faced tomatoes. So that would be just like a big beefsteak tomato.
That takes up the whole, one slice takes up a whole piece of bread.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
and I also love to get the little tiny yellow pear tomatoes, because again, when I do these minimal cooking dishes in the summer, if I have like red tomatoes, yellow tomatoes, and fresh basil, and mixed up with some kind of vinaigrette dressing, and then throw in a little pasta or canned chickpeas or something like that, it's so beautiful, and all the flavors are so fresh. That's great. That's enough for a dinner.
Certainly.
On a hot day, you don't want to cook. Or I'll do some couscous salads, too. I like couscous.
Oh.
And that doesn't really take any cooking. You just boil water, pour it on the couscous, cover the bowl with a plate, and let it sit for 10 minutes, and fluff it around with a fork, and then you have the basis of a salad you can make.
What do you put on couscous?
I use it as for a cold dish. I'll make it into a marinated salad. So I'll always throw in a little turmeric when I cook it, because I like it to turn bright yellow. And not be like a pale off-white. So if it's kind of a bright yellow, it looks very pretty. And then I'll fluff it with a fork and let it get cool. And then I'll toss it with some vinaigrette dressing, usually that I have in the refrigerator. I always make a weekly amount at the beginning of the week. And then I'll add to it like scallions and diced tomatoes and maybe some white beans and make a salad of it. Sometimes pine nuts or sliced almonds.
I'm thinking running home and making myself a snack. Unfortunately, we've come just about to the end of our show, but I'd like you to share with the folks at home where they could get your books.
Well, they should be able to get them anywhere. They're always in bookstores. I know you can get them online easily, Amazon.com. You can get them in the chain bookstores and in the small bookstores. I've been fortunate. They're usually quite easy to find.
Oh, good.
Well, we found this one in the library.
Yep.
Library too.
Vegetarian leisure. But I'm sure there's plenty. And on Amazon.com, you can pick it up.
Well, I certainly.
I have just two of them. What were some of the names of the other ones?
Okay. My first one is, I have five out, but the first one went out of print after 10 years. I have Quick Vegetarian Pleasures, Simple Vegetarian Pleasures, Main Course Vegetarian Pleasures, and Vegetarian Classics.
Well, I'm sure each one is excellent. Certainly the two that we have here in the studio are wonderful.
What was the name of the first one that's out of print?
Vegetarian Pleasures, a Menu Cookbook.
Oh, okay. You got a classic there if anybody's got that one. So,
I recommend the folks at home run out tomorrow and buy one of your books, and I'm sure they'll create wonderful recipes for their families.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you both.
Yeah, it was nice to have you on, and I'll go to bed thinking of all these wonderful things.
That's not such a bad thing to dream about.
It's not at all. Nice talking with you.
The chocolate, white chocolate raspberry cheesecake.
Okay, well, enjoy that, Leo. Okay, nice talking to you, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Yeah, bye now.
That was Jean Lemlin talking to us from her home in Great Barrington
about
her cookbooks that she's written and about her recipes that she's created. Really some wonderful ones.
I like coconut cake and that recipe for the cheesecake, that raspberry white chocolate raspberry cheesecake. But the coconut cake is almost...
All good.
Well, that's good. Yeah, that's good. And I want to try that eggplant thing, that eggplant pate. Roasted eggplant, but
that sounds good.
Anyway, so we had so much fun tonight, and we want to thank everybody for joining us. And you can join us again next week, right here, of course, at the same time. Yeah, but we want to invite you to join us on the LASteelShow.org website for our Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday night show. All three are on at 8:00. 8 to 9 o'clock, and that's on LASteelShow.org. Or you can go, if you miss that up, go to Blog Talk Radio and search for LA Steel Show. LA Steel Show, right?
Okay.
Or you can put LA Steel Show / Blog Talk Radio / LA Steel Show ORG, or just go to LA Steel Show ORG and press on Listen Live. And it'll take you to our host page, and you'll see the whole fantasy world of L.A. Steel Show. You'll see a picture of Lila and I dancing the tango there. Right?
But we're at the end, and it's time to say goodnight.
Yeah.
And how about singing us off?
That's good. We got time for it.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling on till then. Happy trails to you till we meet again. And thanks for choosing the LA Steel Show. Choose us again next week on Tuesday from 8 to 10 with more exciting talk and dialogue and interviews and all of that.
More Lila.
And have a great and peaceful week. Good night, folks.
Yeah.
Thanks for being with us.
All right. Good night, everybody. Have a good night.
Stop. What's that sound? Everybody, look what's going down.
You've been listening.
Okay, I want to thank everybody for hanging in there. I hope you enjoyed both interviews. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. I wanted to also mention that tomorrow night we'll be covering this new work that we've been talking about it's actually an introduction to Drunbelow Melchizedek's work stuff leading into what we'll be talking about Friday night with George Dixon. It's purely ascension consciousness. It's remarkable, really remarkable. Join us on Friday night and tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, and as we delve into the works of Drunbelow and also works of the writing of Ben Frizzell, I believe it's his name was. He wrote this book. And I hope to talk to you tomorrow night. Good night.